And our final case this morning is United States versus Ricky Dixon, case 113802. Mr. Sullivan.
May it please the court, I'm John Sullivan. I'm appointed counsel for Mr. Dixon, appointed in this court on the appeal, appointed to do the motion for reduction of sentence in the district court. I was not his counsel in 2001 for the original sentence that was imposed. There are a variety of, I think the record is fairly simple why we're here. There was a sentence imposed in 2001. I believe that it is subject to reduction under the Fair Sentencing Act because it was involved a sentence that was imposed based upon the guidelines. I filed a motion on Mr. Dixon's behalf in November. The government filed a response on the day we appeared in court on the motion. A week later, the judge heard argument. He denied the motion on the basis of this court's opinion in Ray, United States versus Ray, which says a C1C plea agreement, you can't get a reduction under the Fair Sentencing Act. I then, almost on the morning the judge made that decision, finally received the transcript and said, look at the transcript, Judge. Look to what the prosecutor said on the morning the sentence was imposed and the plea agreement, the amended plea agreement was entered into. How was this sentencing range of 15 to 20 years determined? Spelled out by the prosecutor. At that point in time, the judge ruled that he still couldn't determine, even reading the transcript, whether the parties would have agreed to a sentence reduction if the guidelines had been reduced.
Why is it appropriate to look to the transcript as opposed to being confined to the agreement itself under the concurrence, Justice Sotomayor's concurrence in Freeman?
Because I don't think that Justice Sotomayor, when she used the word look to the agreement, was establishing or espousing or recognizing what I would call a parole evidence-like rule. The judges are never limited in looking to an agreement to determine whether it's fair and appropriate, and especially determine what sentence to impose within a range, to just what the terms of the agreement are. If you actually look at what Justice Sotomayor did, she describes, I'll quote from, I think it is page 2699 to 2700. I won't quote it because it's a little long, but I'll paraphrase it. The sentencing range there just said it should be a sentence of, let me make sure I have it right, 106 months. And then she looks in the agreement and says, well, the agreement calculates a guideline range of 46 months, and we know that there's a mandatory sentence of 60 months. And she then goes outside the agreement and looks and says, oh, well, the 46 months must have been from the guidelines because that's what the guidelines show for that sentencing quantity and for that criminal history. So Justice Mayor, I don't think, Sotomayor, is not trying to espouse a rule that says you can only look to the agreement.
Isn't that the way all other eight members of the Supreme Court understood her to be including? And all of them agreed it was arbitrary? Nevertheless, it's the controlling law.
I find some of the language in the majority, the opinion of the plurality that wanted to reverse and the plurality that wanted to affirm troublesome, because I'm not certain they understood what she was saying the way she said.
She keeps referring to the agreement itself.
I understand that. I understand that. Yet when she talks about it, she doesn't limit her own consideration to just the agreement. Plea agreements rarely, if ever, explain how one gets there. And she specifically talks about this type of plea agreement, which she says should be recognized as one that, where you can get a reduced sentence. She specifically refers to it as involving a sentencing range, not a specific number. So if there is a range, there is some discretion in the district judge. What I suggest that means is that there is some other basis, information, that is given to the judge to determine whether that range is reasonable and fair to the defendant, and then what sentence in that range the judge should consider giving. There's more information. And I don't see any rule or any basis to just exclude evidence. If you could say that the prosecutor's statement was unreliable or untruthful or unreasonable, yes, or questionable. If it were 4 or 5 years after the fact, somebody brought the prosecutor in and said, why did you agree to this range? And he's operating from memory. But we don't have that here. This is a contemporaneous statement that is used to persuade the judge to accept the agreement. He is told this to persuade him to accept the agreement. The judge doesn't have to accept the agreement. He can accept it, he can reject it. The superseding plea agreement was actually at that point in time E1C, which is now C1C. And he was persuaded by what the prosecutor said that it was fair and reasonable. There's no reason to exclude that from consideration on every issue that involves this plea agreement. The judge was deciding questions about that plea agreement. Is it fair to the defendant? Is it reasonable? What's the appropriate sentence that I should apply in that range? And he relied upon the statement of the prosecutor. I think it is unreasonable, and there's no basis to say at this point in time you shouldn't consider it to determine how they got to that range. Well, the judge was told to consider it to determine what sentence to give the man, what sentence to give Mr. Dixon. But now the government says, well, you shouldn't consider it because Judge Sotomayor says the agreement, uses the phrase agreement as if it were the pronouncement of a new rule on what evidence should be considered when looking at a plea agreement.
Well, that's what her words communicate. Her application of the standard, your argument is, suggests something other than what the test is that she actually established, which is confined to the agreement itself. I think an alternative interpretation of her application of her own rule is that she was engaged in some sort of interpretation of the agreement rather than looking to parole evidence in the record to determine what was on counsel's mind, both the prosecutor and the defense attorney, in arriving at the agreement. But I think that's stretching her application of the rule.
But I will take the reverse argument from how you analyze her fact. You're taking from the fact she just uses the word agreement. There was no issue before her whether or not there was other evidence that should have been considered. That's not really discussed anywhere. She uses the shorthand word agreement, and
no, that's critical to her analysis of the statute, the statutory eligibility. The sentence has to be based on a guidelines provision that has since been changed, and a Rule 11C1C agreement and a sentence that flows from it is based on the agreement. It's not based on the guidelines. That was the whole import of two-thirds of her separate opinion, and she agrees with the dissenters on that point. She parts company in how that is to be applied.
But she says that is not the case. That is the case. If the agreement said 60 months, the sentence shall be 60 months and the judge accepts or rejects it. I don't care how much you talk about what the parties intended. Sotomayor would say 60 months and 60 months, and we won't go past that. But she says, she states that the term of imprisonment imposed can never... This conclusion, however, does not mean that the term of imprisonment imposed pursuant to a C agreement can never be reduced. However, for example, the Rule 11 allows the parties to agree to a specific sentencing range that is appropriate disposition of the case. That is exactly what happened in this case. It is not a specific number. It is a range, 15 to 20 years. And notice the language she quotes from the rule doesn't say a specific sentencing guideline range. It says a specific sentencing range. And what we have here is there's a range, and then when it is explained to the judge how the range was determined, it is obvious that the guidelines were the basis for that range. And then Judge Kaur exercised his, well, he did two things. One, he accepted the agreement. And then two, he exercised his discretion under 3553 to pick somewhere in that range based upon what other people got at the low end or half off the range, what other people got at a third off that particular guideline range for similar types of cooperation. And Judge Kaur exercised discretion. He didn't just pick a number that the government had, he didn't agree to a number that the government had already accepted or already established. He was given the discretion to choose within a range, and I think the range is exactly what Judge Sotomayor is talking about.
Thank you. Sean.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. The district court did not clearly err in its interpretation of the plea agreement in this case, and that interpretation follows directly from Justice Sotomayor's concurring opinion. This was an agreement to a term, a range of years. It was not a function, a mathematical function, of a sentencing guideline that was subject to modification by the commission. The couple points about Justice Sotomayor's opinion that I think bear emphasis. One of the key things that she found in that agreement that was before the Supreme Court was that the defendant in that plea agreement had agreed to be sentenced pursuant to the sentencing guidelines. So she found within the agreement itself that the agreement was based on the sentencing guidelines. This plea agreement here before the court today is not that kind of agreement. It is an agreement like the court found in United States versus Ray to be a selected range, a selected sentence by the parties, in this case a range of 15 to 20 years, which makes our case today much more like the Fourth Circuit's case in Brown, which is a post-Freeman case by the Fourth Circuit, in which we have a plea agreement where the parties agreed to 180 to 240, where the judge was then permitted to select pursuant to C1C, wherever in that range the judge decided to flow. And another point of Justice Sotomayor's opinion that's worth emphasis is her statement that the fact that the guidelines informed the parties' negotiations does not matter. That does not make the agreement one based on the guidelines.
Mr. Shaw, would you agree that if the agreement, the written agreement, had said what the AUSA said in explaining the agreement to Judge Kaur, that Mr. Dixon would be statutorily eligible for consideration?
Not quite. Almost. If the plea agreement had said the sentence shall be one-third to, or one-half to one-third off the guidelines, then yes. What I understand the AUSA's statement to be is not that. I don't think the AUSA was saying this sentence is a function of the guidelines. I think what the AUSA was doing was giving the judge comparables so that the judge could understand the magnitude of the sentence that that it should select, and using the guidelines as a frame of reference so that the court could understand, okay, if other defendants were getting sentences.
That's how Justice Sotomayor used them within the Freeman plea agreement, right, where the parties had agreed he would be offense level 19, criminal history category 4. She goes far enough outside to consult the guidelines to say, oh, by the way, that's 46 to 57 months, and lo and behold, we get 46 plus 60 as the agreed sentence.
That's right, Your Honor, and I think what adds to the assessment in the Freeman plea agreement was that part of that agreement was that the sentence shall be determined by the guidelines. And that's what Justice Sotomayor was relying on when she looked at how that end result came about. And I think what's also important is her reflection in response to the dissent.
Agree to have your sentence determined under the sentencing guidelines. That's in essence saying, and I'm not asking for a 5K1 departure for cooperation the way this guy got. Right?
Well, post-Booker, not necessarily. You could have a plea agreement where the parties agreed not to be sentenced under the sentencing guidelines.
Yep, but this was all before Booker, right?
Understood, and that's the same kind of situation that comes up in this court's opinion in Ray, where the guidelines to this day will always inform some of the parties' negotiations, their position. I think I want to focus on what the AUSA said at the sentencing, because we would concede, and we do concede when we have plea agreements that are written as a function of the guidelines, that 3582C applies. But the question before the court at the time the AUSA was making that comment was not what is the agreement, it is what sentence should be imposed. And the best way to advocate and assist the court, because remember the government was bound by the agreement not to take a position on the range between 15 to 20. So what the AUSA said was that range does compare to the guidelines, and here's what other cooperators who did have sentences that were a function of the guidelines, here's what they got. That's there to assist the court in deciding what to impose. And then the ultimate question for Justice Sotomayor was the sentence imposed. Was the sentence imposed based on a foundation of the guidelines? And here, the 190-month sentence does not really map on to the guidelines in that way. And because of the way Rule 11C1C works and its interplay now with 3582C, it's important to focus in on whether the sentence that was imposed.
Let me ask you an unfair question, Mr. Shah. Would you agree with the 8 justices of the Supreme Court that this winds up being an arbitrary rule? And if so or if not, why is the government resisting this request at the eligibility level rather than on the merits level?
If I recall correctly,
the Justice Department has been a forceful advocate for the liberal application of the Fair Sentencing Act and the accompanying guideline changes.
Right. I think my best answer to the question, Your Honor, is that our reading of Justice Sotomayor's opinion retains the party's ability to negotiate C1C agreements, and it's in our interest that when we negotiate a C1C and that it has unambiguous terms, that everybody lives up to those terms. And we could have written a plea agreement in this case that would have made it a function of the guidelines. We do that with great frequency. And when the parties have made that election and the rules require a C sentence to bind everyone involved, we have an interest in making sure we see that through.
Are you telling me this was a conscious decision to draft this way to prevent a 3582 application, anticipating Justice Sotomayor's concurrence?
I can't say that, Your Honor, but what I can say is that it is not uncommon for the parties to negotiate a C1C sentence to a range of years as opposed to a function of the guidelines to hedge our bets, because often the probation office may find a conviction. The guidelines may change. Parties like the certainty of the range of years as opposed to the guidelines, and that was happening even before Booker, as in this case. So I can't say that it was in anticipation of 3582C, but I can say that our position today is consistent with Justice Sotomayor's opinion. It's consistent with this Court's opinion in Ray and Franklin, Fourth Circuit's opinion in Brown, and we'd ask that...
You don't want to tell me whether you think it's arbitrary.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to tell you whether I think it's arbitrary. I think as I understand it, it's not arbitrary because it's consistent with this Court's prior precedent, Ray and Franklin. And so, in my view, it would not be an arbitrary decision on the Court's part. It is in line with how you balance a C agreement with the guidelines and with 3582.
It's not the brightest of lines.
It is not the brightest of lines. And obviously, the Department of Justice had a different position in Freeman itself. The Department's position was the dissent's position.
Do you perceive Justice Sotomayor's application of her own rule to be more an interpretation of the agreement rather than an attempt to go behind it to find out what went into its negotiation?
It must be. It must be an interpretation of the agreement itself, because by her very own language, she says you cannot go behind and look at do a free-ranging search. I think that was her term, a free-ranging search into the party's negotiation. So what she was doing...
If you do that, you know it's based on the guidelines, right? In any case, right?
And then, again, there has to be some daylight between the plurality's approach and Justice Sotomayor's approach. Otherwise, she would have signed on to the plurality opinion. Again, we live with the concurring opinion that we've got, and I do think the district court applied it correctly. And that's why we're here today asking this court to affirm the decision below. And I would like to add one point not raised at oral argument today, but it's in the reply brief. With respect to the merits, even if 3582C applies, a judgment is going to have to be made as to what the correct calculation of the guidelines and that drug quantity calculation would have to be made. And so there is an alternative basis that is apparent from the record. That
would require some fact-finding 12 years after the fact, right?
It would not, because it is all contained in the PSR.
Well, but there was no motivation. We were just talking about collateral estoppel in the last argument. There was no motivation to dispute the difference between 1.5 kilos and 8.5 kilos or 100 kilos of crack back in 2001, was there?
Likely not, although there might have been other consequences to other facts, for example, organizer leader issues,
right. Mm-hmm.
and the like. Nevertheless, this court in, for example, Hall, which is cited in the government's brief at page 22, does accept the proposition that you can look at the PSR, even though it's years later, and even though no one had an incentive to quibble between 1.5 and 4.5 and 8.4, and decide what the facts are. For those reasons, we ask that you affirm the decision.
Thank you. Mr. Sullivan, your time had expired, but I'll give you a minute to rebut.
I'll keep my remarks extremely simple. We are referring to and talking about a time in 2001 when everything was under the guidelines. You couldn't burp in the district court and give a sentence without either being within the guidelines or having a reason to go outside. And if you went any other place, that one party or another brought you up to this court. Everything was under the guidelines. The plea agreements, I find it impossible to understand how the government can argue that in 2001, when everything was under the guidelines, parties were free to negotiate whether or not there was a line in there about whether or not it was under the guidelines. Everything was under the guidelines. I don't understand the comment about hedging bets. I don't think there was any contemplation when this 2001 agreement was drafted that we would be under the Fair Sentencing Act and trying to get a reduction here. I would just comment lastly and most briefly. The Freeman opinion starts off that the Sentencing Reform Act of 1984 called for the creation of sentencing guidelines to inform judicial discretion in order to reduce unwarranted disparities in federal sentences. Goes on to point out that the Fair Sentencing Act was there, created, and passed to, once the guidelines themselves institutionalize some disparity, to correct that. I think we are now 12 years after the fact, and this disparity which has developed ought to be decided in the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and that concludes arguments for today. The court is in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.